gonya mabagi ti baba
sigi gonya
Good morning and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 21st, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning is Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com and is also a writer for the New York Star-Ledger. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for talkingbroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, James. How are you doing?
I almost said hi, Brian. I don't know why. I have no idea. You may notice that I said good morning. It's because we're actually recording on Sunday morning because of other commitments that all three of us have. So we want to jump right into it. One thing that we're going to do a little bit differently this week than previous weeks is that Peter and Matthew are going to talk about different shows. So Peter's going to talk about Boys in the Band, which Matthew hasn't seen. So Peter, why don't you fill us in?
Well, to me, Boys in the Band is one of the iconic plays of the 60s. A lot of people don't like it because it shows a gay man being very unhappy. There's the famous line that's always quoted as an example of how terrible the play is: you show me a happy homosexual and I'll show you a gay corpse. There's also a line, if we could only stop hating ourselves, that's it, you know, if we could only stop hating ourselves. And certainly gay people who were born after this play had met with wonderful success when it was first produced in 68. Hate the play for that reason, because they've lived in a very different time. I maintain the reason they live in a different time is partly to do with The Boys in the Band, which was a pre-Stonewall play. It opened 14 months before Stonewall happened, and I think it's one of the reasons, not the only reason, God knows, but one of the reasons that Stonewall did happen, that so many gay men said, you know, we're just not going to take this anymore. What's interesting to me, too, for those people who always say, it's a pathetic view of gays, gays aren't like that, if you had been sitting in the theater back in the 60s and watching men weep openly at this play, I think you would see that there's something about it that shows that this was the life of the gay man back then. Like it or not, we don't like it, of course, but nevertheless, this was the reality in 1968. So under those circumstances, Boys in the Band should be applauded for helping advance the cause rather than be scorned for showing another era as accurately as it showed it. All right. The first production in New York in 1968, I must admit, I did not see. I saw it the following year in its first sit-down production in Boston, where a number of unknown actors played the parts, but Mark Crawley at the time told the Boston Globe that he thought this company in Boston was better than the original company. He since has told me he doesn't believe that, but he certainly told it then. But I'll tell you, that company in Boston was tremendous. There aren't many people that emerged from it, though Rex Robbins, an actor, was in it, and he went on to have a nice career on Broadway, among many things, playing Herbie to Angela Lansbury's Rose in the 1974 revival of Gypsy. Anyway, to me, when I saw the movie version, I was impressed, too, with the original cast. So I have seen two casts that have been phenomenal, one on film, one on stage. However, I have to say that seeing this new production that the Transport Group is doing, I really started to think that this production, Jack Cummings, really found a way of getting into the play that makes the original productions look very stylized. And I don't want to use the word phony, but I want to use a word second cousin to that. Just very slick. Cummings has found a way to make this party really seem like a real party, as opposed to a play where people are spouting off witticisms every time there's a call for a witticism. We all know in real life, so many times we don't come up with the right line, the clever line, when we'd like to. Time passes and we say, we should have said that. So there were a lot of pauses in this play before somebody comes up, in this production, before somebody comes up with a good line. And that to me makes it more real. I certainly meet with a group of guys every Tuesday night to talk about musical theater. We've been doing it for years and years and years and years. And every now and then, there's a pause. Nobody knows what to say, you know, and that's it. And finally, somebody comes up with something to say. You know, that's the way it happens in real life, and that's the way it happens in this production of Boys in the Band. So that's kind of fascinating. It's also a very different looking production on another front, and that is the fact that you don't go to a theater. What you do is go to an office building on 26th Street, 37 West, and you take an elevator to the 12th floor, and then you climb a flight of stairs to get to this penthouse. And it's been done as an apartment, and there are just a lot of chairs around, and I mean chairs. I mean no arms. I mean just chairs. They're not folding chairs. They're stronger than that, but nevertheless, they are chairs. And you sit on the periphery. It's hard to say what stage right or stage left, because it really is in the semi-round, in an oval, you sit around the action. Theater in the semi-round. Everybody has a good seat because you're really on top of these guys. And it, for those of us who like to sit close, and I've always been somebody who enjoys a front row seat, you get to see expressions quite nicely here. All right. So for those who don't know this play at all, this is about Michael, who's having people over because Harold is having his birthday. He's 32 years old, Harold is, and everybody's going to come and celebrate the birthday. What happens, too, is that Michael gets a phone call from his old college chum, Alan McCarthy, and Alan says, I need to see you desperately. And Michael doesn't want him to because Michael has never told Alan that he's gay. He's lived this very closeted life. So he tells Alan not to come, but Alan eventually comes. He's that distraught, and he walks in, and Michael is terribly embarrassed that he has been found out to be with all these men. It's clearly a gay party, and it doesn't take all that long for Alan to figure that out. So that's the struggle. That's the first part of the play. The second part involves a very interesting game where Michael says, we're going to play a game and call the person we really loved. And everybody, not everybody, but many of them get on the phone and call the person they really loved. And then Michael wants Alan to do that too, claiming that Alan really loved a man more than anybody else in his life. It leads to a very interesting and surprising ending. And there are more jokes in the play than Neil Simon, I think, ever put in any one of his. So it's a lot of fun to hear lines like, well, there's one thing to say for masturbation. You don't have to look your best. That's just one of many. What's interesting to me, the audience I was with did not laugh at very many of the lines. And I suspect, because I could clearly see it was an older crowd, it was easy to see who the people were, or it was a lot of critics the night I went, that what we were seeing were people who knew the play inside out. So that was interesting. It was also very interesting to hear the stony silences of seething hatred whenever the F word was used. And I don't mean the word fuck. I mean a different word, a six-letter word beginning with F that's often been used in the past to describe a homosexual. And you could really feel the fury in the room at that happening. But nevertheless, I do believe everybody had a very good time at this show because I can see their faces very easily. And there were plenty of smiles, and certainly people were engaged. As for the performances, I would say that everybody works extraordinarily well, but I think that the actor playing Emery was miscast. Not because he wasn't very good. He was, in fact. And in fact, even though Emery is supposed to be the most effeminate of the men, he wasn't played as a camp stereotype, which was interesting because this role has often been called a camp stereotype. And watching this actor play it made me realize that perhaps it was the original actor, Cliff Gordon, who made it into an effeminate stereotype. This guy isn't over the top in that way, and I found that refreshing. The only thing is that he's lost a great deal of his hair. And he has a line in the play where he criticizes Michael for losing his hair. Well, Michael has substantially more hair than this Emery does, so Emery would not bring up hair loss to this guy, considering that he's lost substantially more. There are little things like that that show a lack of attention to detail. But frankly, the mood of the play was so potent that I came away really respecting it far more than I did the original mounting. And it really surprised me amazingly. Those of us who know the play inside out will notice that there have been some cuts. Some lines have been shaved from it. But the most fascinating one is one where somebody points out that Hank and Larry, two of the guests, are over 30. And And Larry says, Hank's the one who's over 30. And the answer, and the rejoinder is, you're pushing it. That line was cut because Christopher Invar is playing Larry, and clearly he's over 30, so they dropped that line. There are some lies shaped here and there, but I found it really mesmerizing. It almost seems as if Jack Cummings had asked the cast, don't do anything that would happen in the movie. We're taking a completely different approach, because I don't think there was more than five line readings that even remotely resembled the movie. The only thing that did seem like the movie was the way that Harold, the birthday guest, walked. He walked exactly the same way Leonard Fry walked in the movie. But aside from that, for those people who have seen Boys in the Band and think they know it very, very well, I think they're going to find this quite a revelation.
So we want to say the Boys in the Band is going to play through March 14th at the Transport Group. And Peter mentioned that it's at 37 West 26th, which is not exactly the theater district, kind of more Chelsea and office buildings. So it must be an interesting space there.
Yeah, no question.
Can I say something really quick? One thing I do think is really interesting about the Boys in the Band from a history standpoint is that, at least in the last, you know, decade or so, it's really inspired a lot of imitators or plays that have responded to it. One of the more high-profile ones, I guess, was from 6 or 7 years ago. It was called The Last Sunday in June, which is set on the day of the Gay Pride Parade. It uses a very similar setup of all the guys in the apartment commenting on stuff and doing this and that. And it makes a lot of references to the Boys in the Band and the way that it works and the kind of stereotypes that it deals with and the structure of it. And then at the Fringe Festival last summer, I saw another one that was a very Seinfeldian, very comic take on it that was called, I believe, The Boys Upstairs. And it was the same basic idea, but done in the style of a straight-out sitcom rather than a play kind of like The Boys in the Band. So I think that really, whether you like or you hate The Boys in the Band, that it has had kind of a profound impact on the way that gay people are presented on stage then and now.
Since you mentioned The Last Sunday in June, I thought about mentioning this. Yes, The Last Sunday in June by Jonathan Tolens was a play of some years ago that does, as Matthew says, take place in a gay pride parade day that everybody comes to watch the parade. But one gentleman shows up and says, I have been homosexual. I'm not going to do it anymore. We lead superficial lives. We're only concerned about our bodies. We're concerned about growing older. It's so silly. I am going straight. So that's the conflict in that play. And there's a very interesting exchange where one gentleman says, you know, we have such a good time. What's wrong with having a good time? I mean, we go to restaurants so many times. I see straight people looking at us. We're laughing, we're having a wonderful time, and you can see that they envy the fact that we're laughing, that we enjoy ourselves so much. And somebody else then says, if only we could stop liking ourselves so much. That's it, you know. If only we could stop liking ourselves so much. And that, of course, is a direct reference to if only we could stop hating ourselves, you know. That's it, you know. I mean, so that's very interesting to me that in less than 40 years, fewer than 40 years, we had a change of attitude there, a total change. It would have been impossible for any of us in 1968 to believe that that line would become, if only we could stop liking ourselves so much. And that was really, really a very tangible way for me to see how much progress had been made in less than 40 years.
So Matthew is going to review A Lie of the Mind, which is off-Broadway at the Acorn Theater. Matthew, what'd you think?
Well, I am really kind of one of those people that goes back and forth on Sam Shepard. Some of his plays I really like a lot, and some of them I think wear out their welcome a little bit more than they should. But this is really a very good play, and it's a very good production by the new group of it. One of the things that it does is that it really compresses and trims and I don't know, slims down what... Now, I didn't see the original production, and I hope Peter did and that he can tell us about it in a minute. But the original production was reportedly 4 hours long, and the script certainly is in three acts, and this production is done in two acts, and it's less than 3 hours. So obviously they did a lot to kind of make it more manageable for modern audiences, but I was really very taken with it. It's a very interesting story that really melds a lot of the different ways that Sam Shepard looks at relationships. You have the two brothers who who have a very kind of fractured relationship, and you have the various men and women who either get along or much more frequently don't, and the parents and the children that have issues that either need to be resolved or will never be resolved, all sort of colliding between these two families who are united by a couple where the male, the husband beat up his wife because he thought that she was having an affair, which she probably wasn't, and she's left very brain damaged and can barely even speak and is being cared for by her parents in Montana while he's in California, and wants to sort of get back together with her. And the play is really about not so much is that a good idea, which is probably the way it would have been written today, but what is necessary in order to make that happen. And it's very well acted. Maren Ireland, whom Peter and I have both spoken very highly of on this podcast last year when she was in Reasons to Be Pretty, plays the wife. And she just is so great at creating this voice that really suggests that there's something disconnected in the brain. She can't form the proper words. She's really just sort of pained by the fact that she's lost the sense of communication that everyone in Sam Shepard plays always seems to have trouble with. And the husband is played by Alessandro Nivola, who I can't recall ever having seen anything before, but he's got a very intense sort of hard edge about him that really makes him a very compelling person to follow through the story. And he really suggests that the character has a long way to go in order to get to the place where he's going to be able to sort of redeem himself to his wife and her family. Keith Carradine is in it. He plays Maren Ireland's father, Laurie Metcalf, who was recently, I thought, terrific in Brighton Beach Memoirs, and I'm assuming she would have been terrific in Broadway Bound too, but we didn't see that. She plays the mother. They're wonderful. They're very low-key, very quiet, but I'm always one of the people who thinks that usually when you bring stuff down, you end up elevating it because the audience has to work a little bit more to get everything. And really their performances are excellent examples of that because they really communicate the tension and the drama between this older married couple that really could be where this younger married couple is heading. And the mother on the husband's side is played by Karen Young, who originated the role of her daughter in the original. And the daughter, it really has a very strange relationship with her brother, and where they both had really different conceptions of what life with their father was like. Their father died in kind of a drunken beer hopping thing a while back. So it really is interesting to have the daughter, literally in this case, grow up to be the mother. And I think she really adds something to the atmosphere of the play, suggesting that there really is this timeline of events that really can lead to good things or bad things, but that is always leading to something, and you have to find a way to deal with it. And that's, I'm not going to say it was completely unintentional, because I really don't think that you just sort of accidentally cast the actor who played a younger role in the original production. I don't think any of that ever just happens coincidentally, but she does very well. The direction is by Ethan Hawke, who has a history of working with a new group, and it's very tight, and it's very dark, and it's very nuanced. There are a couple of little stage pictures, especially at the beginning, that maybe aren't thought out as well as they could, that really make it a little bit too abstract, because much of the rest of the production is very realistic. It takes place on a not-so-realistic set of a big wall of furniture, desks and chairs and things of that nature that to me gave the impression of a very cluttered life that needs order brought to it, and you kind of watch the order unfold on the stage. And it was all very effective to me and very interesting to watch a take on the play that apparently is quite different from the original. I obviously didn't see it, but I was reading Frank Rich's review, and he made it sound like the original was, in a good way, very disjointed and very dark and very fluid and cinematic. And this one struck me as being entirely theatrical in a good way, and making use of concepts and themes that really could only happen on the stage. So if you're in the area and you have 2 hours and 45 minutes as opposed to 4 hours to spend on A Lie of the Mind, I definitely recommend it. It's really, I think, one of Sam Shepard's strongest plays, But after you see it, you kind of really understand how he works as a playwright and what he has to say about the way America functions by dint of the people who are in it. And that's a common theme in a lot of his plays, but it comes out here in this play and in this production much stronger than I've seen almost any other time I've been at a Sam Shepard play.
Matthew, have you seen any other performances in this space?
Yes, it's at the Acorn Theater, which is upstairs at Theater Row. I've seen a lot of stuff there. It's kind of the new group's official, unofficial home off Broadway. But I've seen a lot of stuff there. It's a very wide space. It's a little bit industrial. It doesn't have a lot of character, I guess. But the new group always makes a very good use out of it because it is a much wider than usual kind of semi-proof. I don't know if there's an actual arch. I guess there really isn't. But it's that kind of a space, and it works well for this because really you get a sense of the expansiveness and you have plenty of room to see the different stage areas. One side of the stage is the bed is the husband's bedroom in California. The other is the family home in Montana, and there's a section in the center where the injured wife kind of holds court, which suggests it really is in between those two places, and they kind of need to find common ground and meet in the middle. So they make a very good use of that, and it's an effective staging. Ethan Hawke, I think a lot of people are familiar with his acting, which is generally quite good, but he's ending up being a very good director too. This isn't the first time he's directed for the new group. He directed a play of theirs a couple of years ago. I was not as taken with that as I was with this, so he really seems to be improving as an artist on the other side of the footlights, which I think is terrific.
And this this space is about 199 seats. I'm looking at the Acorns.
Yeah, it sounds right. It's smallish. So.
Yeah. So and the tickets are $61.25.
Peter, did you see the original production?
No.
You did?
No, I. No, I don't believe I was reviewing at the time that it took place. And I have to say that I respect Sam Shepard tremendously, and I really think that his works do what they set out to do. They do offer a worldview that is seldom mine. So if I'm not reviewing, I'm not likely to buy a ticket to a Sam Shepard play. And again, this is just a case, like if you go into a restaurant and somebody were to order me liver, offer me a part of his meal, which is liver, I'm not going to take it because it's just not my taste. So that's really all I'm talking about here. So I almost killed Sam Shepard. Inadvertently, but I had to do a
gloss over that.
Yeah, what had happened was Fool for Love was being done at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, and he was supposed to call me to do an interview, and he finally did, much too late to actually do the story, but I thought, well, he's on the phone, let me talk to him. He was calling from his car, and unfortunately I really did make a type of faux pas, because I talked about, was that early in your Hollywood career, in the middle of your Hollywood career, and suddenly he realized I was just about to say, though I did stop from saying it, you know, or at the end of your Hollywood career, you know, as an actor. And he started laughing so hard, you know, it was just amazing. And suddenly you heard the screech of brakes, you know, I mean, that I don't know where he was, but I mean, you know, you heard him say, oh shit, you know, and so, but he lived to tell the tale. But I think my giving him that line about the end of your Hollywood career made him laugh so hard he wasn't paying attention to where he was driving. I have no idea where he was or what he was doing, but anyway, I'm very glad that he survived, because Lord knows he's a playwright that speaks to a lot of people, and I respect that tremendously.
All right, Peter, why don't we move into your review of Calvin Berger at the George Street.
Calvin Berger is a musical written by a young man named Barry Weiner, who teaches for a living in a middle school, and so he knows about kids and what makes them tick. And what he's done is take Cyrano de Bergerac and set it in a high school, actually. And I think it's a very smart thing to do, because Cyrano de Bergerac is now Calvin Berger, who is tremendously worried about his big nose and how indeed he's not attractive to any girls, especially Rosanna, not Roxanne, but Rosanna. Now, the smart thing about this musical, there are many smart things about this musical, and I think it's going to have a wonderfully long life, is that Rosanna is not at all superficial. This is a girl who gets involved with all sorts of school activities, but her favorite one is that she wants to do a benefit to give money to homeless children. So there's no question that she's an intelligent girl who really has a sense of purpose, and that's really great. That doesn't mean that she doesn't fall for Matt, who's the Christian of this story. Good-looking boy, real hunk, on the wrestling team. And the kid who plays it, David Hull, certainly lives up to what this role demands physically, believe me. And good looks, too. I mean, it's perfectly cast. So she goes to Calvin and says, will you find out if he likes me? You know, and God knows that's very high school, you know, that nobody has the nerve to ask, do you like me? They have to send an emissary to do that, you know. And so so that's part of what goes on there. Now, what Barry Weiner has done is not follow the Cyrano plot exactly. In the second act, it goes in its own direction, which is really great. For one thing, there's a fourth character, only four characters, but the fourth character is a girl named Brett. And Brett likes Calvin, but he just can't see her because he's just so interested in Rosanna. So you have that complication. But also what happens here is after Calvin writes the letters for the love letters for Matt, because Matt is quite is stupid the word I'm looking for. And it's very, very well done in the way that he's portrayed as stupid. One line just out of many is that when he hears about this, do you know that there are 400,000 homeless children on the street? Oh my God, he says, how can anybody drive? You know, so as a result, he's really, really dim-witted. But what happens here that doesn't happen in the original Cyrano is that our Cyrano, Calvin, gets jealous of this situation. You know, here he is, these two are together now, Matt and Rosanna, and they're dating, and everybody's getting, and now he's jealous. You know, I mean, after all, he's the one who made it happen. If it weren't for him, it wouldn't have happened. So that's something that doesn't happen in the original Cyrano de Bergerac. And also the complications with the other girl, who certainly wants to see Calvin getting involved with her. What this is really is High School Musical with great intelligence, great wit, characters that aren't stereotypes, a lot of charm, a lot of heart, a lot of soul. The lyrics are sparklingly wonderful. Many, many laughs among the lyrics. Exactly in the right place. Barry's a product of the BMI workshop where they learn about craft, and he's done it extraordinarily well. And frankly, if young teenage girls want to go to this, I guarantee you they'll be more impressed with David Hull than they were with Zac Efron. So this really, I think, does have a future. And I have a feeling it's not only going to have a nice off-Broadway run, because Kathleen Marshall, yes, the same Kathleen Marshall who won two Tonys for Wonderful Town and Pajama Game, has done a lovely job of directing. It's crisp as opposed to slick. There is a difference. And I do believe that it's going to have a nice run, and then it's going to be done everywhere in high schools and even middle schools. So I saw it a few years ago in Gloucester, Massachusetts. This is the second production. I liked it then. I liked it more now. I can't say for sure what's been changed. But nevertheless, I know my feelings for it, which were strong in Gloucester, are substantially stronger now. So I wish it the best, and I have a feeling all of us will be talking about it.
All right, so that's going to be, it's playing now through March 14th at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
An easy commute from New York, by the way. You get off the train at New Brunswick and you're about a 5-minute walk away from the theater. It's not hard to get to at all.
And some good restaurants right in that town there. So
it's a lovely town. It really
get out
is.
There early and remember to turn off your cell phones. Matthew, you got a chance to see Clybourne Park. Why don't you tell us about that?
I did see Clybourne Park. It's by Bruce Norris, who had a play a few years ago called The Pain and the Itch, which was about a family that has that makes a lot of claims about tolerance with respect to other cultures and other types of people that don't really play out when the doors are closed and no one else is looking. And really, Clybourne Park is very much along the same lines and deals with pretty much exactly the same subject matter, but in a very different, very sharper, and a much funnier way. This is really an astonishingly funny comedy that really has a very dark and serious kind of underpinning to it. It's basically the same subject matter as David Mamet's Race, which is on Broadway right now, and which I liked a great deal, but this one does not pretend to be anything but a comedy, and it lets all the other stuff simmer underneath, which you know, it was so interesting because last week we were talking about the Pride, which takes place in 2 years across 50 years, one in 1958 and one in 2008. And here we go again. This play takes place in 1959 and 2009, just in America instead of Britain. And it deals with an issue other than sexuality, which is sort of race and sort of classism, in that in 1959, a white couple is moving out of their neighborhood in Chicago, and they're moving for a number of reasons that I don't want to get into now because they might spoil something, but they're moving for a number of reasons, and they're approached by, I don't know if he's really the leader of the homeowners association, but he's certainly the envoy and the spokesman for it, who comes to them and says, you know that the family who's moving in after you is black, right? And of course, they didn't know that because they had nothing to do with selling the house. They turned it over to a real estate agent who took care of all of that for them. And the concern is that when the black people move in, the home values will go down, and they really don't want that to happen. And it's very interesting in that all of that discussion is played out in front of the black servant that this family has and her husband who has come to pick her up. She's come to work on a Saturday to help them pack up and get moving and all that. So all of this plays out in front of them, and there are a lot of funny scenes here. Really, it's one of those cases where the laughs keep building throughout the first act, and you don't think that he's going to be able to continue on with the theme, and then he does, and the laughs just really don't stop. But there's a wonderful scene where the leader of the homeowners association, who's played by Jeremy Shamos, who's a very wonderful, very talented younger actor who was in Gutenberg the musical and gave a wonderful performance at Playwrights Horizons a couple of years ago in a play called 100 Saints You Should Know. Really, he plays very nicely the kind of under the table sort of hatred of black people. And he has a great take when he comes to the door and he sees they're inside and he's like, I really don't want to come in. But anyway, so he has this wonderful scene where he talks to the black maid, Francine, and says, well, you know, the Jewish grocery store nearby, surely you can understand what it must be like to go to a grocery store and not be able to find the kind of food that you and your family like. So if you were to move into this neighborhood, how would you deal with that? And the husband adopts this completely ridiculously Southern stereotypical black voice and says, oh, I just can't live without pig's feet and collard greens. And the entire play is filled with that kind of thing that really tweaks the notion of how people approach race and how they deal with each other on the subject. But the real part of the play that really stands out for me as being very different and very somewhat daring, it's not quite as unusual as it might sound from a plot synopsis, but in the second act, which again takes place in 2009, the neighborhood has been transformed into, it's basically now an all-black neighborhood with higher property values, not lower property values. They did go down for a while, but then they came up, and now this is a very trendy, very really in demand neighborhood. So of course white people want to move in. And a couple who is played again by Jeremy Shamos and Annie Parise, who played a couple in the 1950s, they want to knock down the house, or not knock it down, but redesign and renovate the house that we spend all the time in the first act. But the new homeowners association doesn't like that because they're afraid that will change the property values. And one of the people who has joined them is a black woman who I believe her aunt was her great aunt or something like that was the black maid from the first act. And of course, it's played by the same actress. There were seven performers, and they all double in the second act as sort of the descendants and all that. And it's really interesting to see how her perspectives on race have been informed by what happened before and what else has happened in society, and how for her, certain kinds of prejudice may or may not be okay if they're phrased in a certain way. There's really a fantastic scene that's funny, but it's not funny in the way you expect, because she makes sort of this offhand remark about how, well, I'm sure you can understand how we might feel about the property values, and there's a certain history to this neighborhood that the Jeremy Shamos character interprets as we don't want white people here. But when he tries to say, I don't appreciate being talked to in that way, then of course they're very defensive. No, that isn't what we meant. We would never actually say that. And a whole big argument erupts over that. And then the entire play becomes about how the language mutates and changes and really affects the way that people deal with concepts like this. And is it possible to really ever, I mean, because race, David Mamet's play is about, is it possible for white people to understand what black people go through? And this generalizes it even more to say, is it possible for black people and white people to ever really understand each other, even when they're in exactly the same circumstances? And I thought that was very interesting. The acting is almost spectacular. There was one performer I didn't think was really quite up to the challenges of the play, but Frank Wood plays the husband who's moving out, and he really gives a wonderful little kind of performance that again doesn't really let you know what it's about until very late, and he reappears later as the contractor who sort of plays a major role in what the final fate of the house is. And Crystal A. Dickinson and Damon Gupton are the black family, and they're wonderful at kind of playing a little bit of the sitcom stereotype in the first act, and then showing how that's kind of morphed into the societal norm in the second act. Brendan Griffin plays a priest who has his own sort of views on all of this, and Jeremy Shamos and Annie Paris are wonderful as the married couple who's kind of at the center of all of the problems in both acts. Annie Paris is very interesting because in the first act she plays a character who's deaf, and she has to do the whole thing with the voice and not really being able to communicate vocally. And in the second act, she can hear and she can speak just fine, but she has trouble communicating for very different reasons. So it really is a very smart play in the way it points out the way that the different people and the different kind of types of characters have changed over the last 50 years, but are really still suffering from the same kinds of problems in the same kinds of ways. And as I've said before, it's incredibly funny. It's really difficult to describe exactly why it's so funny, except that every possible permutation of comedy that could be derived from this set of circumstances, Bruce Norris somehow manages to get to. He has every sort of person being all sorts of condescending to every other person for all sorts of various reasons. There's a fantastic scene in the second act where they get into a joke-telling contest to see, well, not exactly a contest official, but to see who could tell the most offensive joke based on the various ethnic and sexual makeups of all the people in the room and the way that they keep topping each other and what happens. It's all very smart in showing how prejudice and stereotypes and the way we try to avoid dealing with those becomes the culture for better or worse. And it's really a fantastic play. It's one of the funniest plays of the season so far, I think. And really, Playwrights Horizons earlier this year had Circle Mirror Transformation in its smaller upstairs space that was a theater-oriented play about a bunch of people and how they grow over the course of 10 weeks or whatever it was. That really was just an astonishing look at human emotions. And this one is much funnier and it's much less open in that way, but it really says something very incisive about the way Americans deal with a very difficult and incendiary subject sometimes. So Playwrights Horizons is having a really good year on the basis of these two plays. So if you haven't been sampling what they've been offering yet, this is a fantastic time to go over there and see what they're all about, because this is as good as it gets, really, I think. So,
Matthew, I have a question. Clybourne Park is the place where the Youngers in Raisin in the Sun move.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't get into that. It is sort of a kind of a riff on that. It's not so much the black people are, again, there are many more white people than black people in the cast, and the characters are predominantly white. But yes, that's very relevant to the way that the play unfolds, and a lot of the scenes, especially with the guy who's trying to convince them not to leave for this reason or that reason, that's very important. But they never refer to it. It always is. It's always on the periphery. It does not ever does not ever come in. But yes, that's what's going on in the background.
So we don't get the impression that that black family that's moving in the first act are Walter and Ruth.
They never name them.
Okay.
Never name. I mean, that's. I think that's the conclusion you're supposed to draw. And
I see.
In the second act, there is the black woman who now is there and wants to prevent the white people from moving. Her name is Lena. So there is that. There is that connection there, but it's never stated explicitly. Which again, I think, makes it much more powerful and much more interesting that he doesn't draw attention to that aspect of what he's doing, and that's what. So many playwrights do is they'll sort of work in all of these really, you know, hints to sort of let the audience members who are in on it say, oh, yes, you get to think you're really clever because you realize what we're talking about. Here, he doesn't give the audience that chance. He says, if you know it, you're going to pick up on it. If you don't, I'm not going to give you anything that makes you feel bad for not understanding that play, and you don't need to know it. It's sort of reflections on it and the way that you might view it from a different point of view. But if you don't know A Raisin in the Sun, you don't lose out a single thing.
All right, this is going to be playing through March 7th, so you only have about 2 weeks at Playwrights Horizon. There's actually some 2-for-1 offers I saw online for this, so you can get out there and go with a date for $65 for both of you to go see this, and it'd be great. In this week's news, we hear that A View from the Bridge is not going to extend its Broadway engagement, even though the business is pretty good for it. It seems like, although this is not official, it seems like star casting has cut both ways on this show, with big Hollywood stars in it that sold a lot of tickets but can't quite extend because they have other commitments and engagements. What do you guys think?
Well, isn't it too that Fences has been booked into the theater with very short notice? I mean, they have virtually no lead time to get in there. I think that was as much of a consideration as anything else.
That's true. And there was talk about moving to the Neil Simon, where Ragtime closed a few months ago, although it's a considerably larger theater, but I think they could have made a run in it.
I was going to say, I believe that the last View from the Bridge played at the Neil Simon with Anthony LaPaglia. It seemed to me that's where it was. I could be wrong about that, but that's my memory of it. So it wouldn't be unprecedented for View to show up there.
The other part of this that I think Michael Riedel pointed out in his column is that Scarlett Johansson has to do publicity for some movie that she shot. And so she was going to have to leave after April 4th or whatever it is anyway. And the hope was that they would be able to get her to come back. So maybe they just discovered or decided that that really was not a realistic possibility. Or maybe they'll keep the sets around, and if something happens in a play somewhere is not very successful, they'll bring it back and, you know, call it the triumphant return or whatever. I don't know. I don't think the story is necessarily finished, but I think that, you know, I'm sure that they've budgeted for this and that they plan for it, and it'll still be financially successful. It's just a question of they have all the great buzz from the reviews and from Scarlett Johansson. It's not going to probably be the barnstormer that something like A Steady Rain was, but, you know, what can you do? That's showbiz.
What's so sad, of course, is that moving a show has become so prohibitively expensive. In the old days, it was amazing to me. I noticed when I was working on stories about Fanny that while Fanny played the Schubert, it then moved to the Belasco after a while. And only played about a few weeks, but still in those days, it was considered worthwhile to move a show, even if it was going to play a few weeks. Bajor only played a few weeks after it moved. Once Upon a Mattress is famous for moving 4 or 5 times. In fact, it was known at the time as the only show that was on tour in New York because it was moving so many times. But now the union's expenses have been so prohibitive that moving even across... I mean, You're in Town closed somewhat prematurely. I mean, yeah, it had been there 2 years, but it could have run longer if it didn't have to get out of that space, which they were building the new building over what is now the Henry Miller Theater, so they had to leave. And they said that it would cost too much to move. Think of what the set to You're in Town was. Really, the three of us could have gone over there and moved the whole set in a half hour. I mean, and yet it was just considered too expensive by union standards. So that's a real sad thing that's been taken away from us.
And Peter, didn't David Merrick do a famous move of 42nd Street from the St. James to the...
No, he was at the Majestic.
Majestic and, to the St. James or
right across the street because Phantom was coming in, and that's where he also did the famous thing of starting his show at 8:15, hoping the people in line, hoping to get into Phantom of the Opera when it was a white hot ticket. You know, standing in that cancellation line, standing there right till 8 o'clock, and then they'd have no other show to go to. Well, they could go right across the street and see his show wasn't starting yet till 8:15. So, America when he was good was really good.
I just want to say that's a really good idea. And I'm really surprised that that kind of thing hasn't been done more often because that's smart, I personally think. But, you know, I think that the other aspect of shows moving is that shows still can move. I think we talked about the 39 Steps
sure.
a while back, and it's about ready to go into its fourth theater. Now, granted, it's moving from Broadway to off-Broadway, but still it's possible. And I can't remember, and I think I've said this before, I can't remember the last time that a show played three theaters, let alone four. So, you know, it does still happen, but it's a lot harder, and it does only seem to happen with these smaller shows rather than the big ones.
Chicago played three theaters, hasn't it? Because I think it started at the Richard Rogers,
moved to the Schubert.
Now it's the Ambassador, yeah. But again, that's a show that doesn't cost that much to move, and I think that was part of the consideration, and the fact that it was worth the expense to move because it was still doing well, and I mean, my God, where is it, Matthew, in the list of the longest-running shows?
It is right near the top. As of today, in fact, since The Lion King has taken over as the eighth longest-running show, it is number six with 5,508 performances.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive, I have to say.
Sure. That's so more than five times its original run.
Yeah, we want we
six
all
six times.
We wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Want to mention that Lion King did become the eighth longest running Broadway show I guess this week sometime. Matthew, why don't you give us the top 10?
Okay, the top 10, according to Playbill Online, and actually it says here that the performance is actually happening today, so that's great. The top 10 are Phantom of the Opera, 9,179 performances. Cats, 7,485, that closed in 2000. Les Mis Rob, 6,680, that closed in 2003, I believe. A Chorus Line closed in 1990 with 6,137. The revival of O Calcutta with 5,959. Chicago, as we talked about, is still running. It's a revival, 5,508. Beauty and the Beast, 5,461, that closed a few years ago. Lion King, 5,125, still running. That's the total as of the performance today, by the way. Rent, which just closed in 2008, 5,124. And Miss Saigon, 4,097. I think that closed in 2001. So a lot of British shows there, but it's
and a lot of musicals.
Absolutely, yes, pretty much
all musical. Yeah, depending how you view O Calcutta, but nevertheless,
that wasn't always the case, was it, Peter?
It certainly wasn't. I got interested in theater in 1961 when the longest running show was Life with Father at 3,224, followed by Tobacco Road with 3,182, and AB's Irish Rose with 2,327. I would soon see My Fair Lady outrun AB's Irish Rose and finish at 2,717. But it was very interesting to me looking back on these figures. It took 10 years before anything in my theater going experience from 61 to 71 before Fiddler on the Roof overtook Life with Father. And that became the long run champ. Now, you notice Matthew didn't even mention it because it isn't even that high. But here's what I find interesting. In 1982, almost 28 years ago, when Death Trap closed, the longest running shows that were not musicals were Life with Father, in this order now, Life with Father, Tobacco Road, AB's Irish Rose, Gemini, Death Trap, Harvey, Born Yesterday, Mary Mary, The Voice of the Turtle, and Barefoot in the Park. That was the top 10. That was 28 years ago. Now, notice in the musical list, only two shows were alive and well back in 1982 that are on that list today. And that's pretty interesting to me. Only two, Chorus Line and O Calcutta, predate 1982. However, if you look at the long run list of plays today, you will find that they're the exact same 10. No play has cracked that top 10 list, while eight shows have topped the list in the musical department, they've gone on to be long runners. There's no question that the day of the play running a long time is long over. The only prediction I really feel I'm safe in making is that no play will ever outrun Life with Fathers 3,224, which is essentially 8 years. Plays just don't run that long anymore. We're in a musical-centric Broadway, like it or not, but nevertheless, that's the case. And it's just seemingly impossible for a play to even hit 1,000 performances, let alone the 1530 that the number 10 entry, Barefoot in the Park, hit. So I certainly believe that that top 10 list of plays is going to stay where it is for a long time to come, if not forever.
It's interesting that you were talking about how some of the top musicals when you first got interested in theater were in the 2000 range, and they were the longest running musicals. I think about Frank Wildhorn's Jekyll and Hyde that ran for 1,543 performances, and I think that the rumor is it took a loss.
Oh, sure, no question.
So it ran for four some odd years. It closed in a loss.
Sure. Theoretically, a show could run forever and not pay back a dime. All you have to do is meet expenses. It doesn't mean that you're paying back your investors. But if you meet expenses, why not keep going? Something could happen. You might get a movie sale. There might be some strange increase in business. And people are working. What's the harm? Why should you close it if you're meeting expenses? But what you're not doing when you're meeting expenses is paying back the original investment. So that's the problem. So, it's very, very possible for a show to run a long, long time and not pay anything back to its investors. So, but in the old days, when you ran a long time, you paid back your investors. You had the money to do it. The profits were there, but it's just so expensive now to do anything. So even with the terribly high ticket prices, it's still hard to pay back the original investment.
Seemingly, paying back the investors is somewhat a U.S. type of thing. The Dunmore Warehouse over in London is about to embark upon Sondheim at 80, which is a series of Sondheim shows to celebrate the 80th birthday of Stephen Sondheim. And I was wondering if, A, you were thinking about getting on a plane to go over and see some of these shows, or if there's going to be some sort of celebrations in the U.S. here for Sondheim's 80th that you know about.
No, I am not going to the Dunmore Warehouse to see any of these shows, no more than I did go down to the Kennedy Center a few years ago when they had their big splash of Sondheim shows. I've seen every original cast of every Sondheim show since 1965, since Do I Hear a Waltz. And as a result, when I thought about going down there, I thought, you know, I could take two tickets and see the shows and have a perfectly decent and wonderful time. But nevertheless, there are people who are hungering to see these shows who have never seen them before. So as a result, I decided not to take the two tickets and let two people eagerly get in and experience the wonders of seeing a Sondheim show for the first time. So for the same reason, I'm not going to go to the Dunmore Warehouse. So I'll stay here in America and see some new shows. Matthew, are you going?
I am not. There is a concert at the Philharmonic next month that people can go to on March 15th and 16th that people can go to if they don't really want to go to the Dunmore Warehouse to see the shows there. I'm actually not in plans to go to the concert either because, Peter, as with you, I would much rather see new shows. And Sondheim shows are revived so often in New York, I feel like I've seen almost all of them anyway. And with the concert of Anyone Can Whistle that Encores is doing in just a few weeks, I think I will be very close to completing the set. So I don't feel a need to go to the concert either. But I did go down to the Kennedy Center in 2002, and that was a pretty good time. Not all the productions were perfect, but there was some good stuff there, and I'm just glad I got the opportunity to go. So I'd seen the original productions of them, I'm not sure I would have bothered either. So, yeah, that's perfectly valid.
March 22nd is the actual birthday of Stephen Sondheim and Andrew Lloyd Webber, we might add. And Sondheim will be turning 80. We're going to have a special episode of Broadway Radio this week on Broadway, where we're going to try and get some folks in to give us some of recollections of Stephen Sondheim and his music and his stories and things like that. So be on the lookout for that episode. I also wanted to mention that last week we talked about Mr. Brantley's column about cell phones, and one of my favorite websites, Broadway Abridged, which is somewhat of a satire website, published a faux article from Mr. Brantley that said, it's okay if they're my friends and they don't have to pay a single dime for their ticket. So we'll put a link to the Broadway Abridged site in the show notes so you can go read it for yourself. It's Broadway Abridged comes up with some pretty funny things. So next week, Peter is off to Pittsburgh, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to go see Time After Time, Stephen Cole and Jeffrey Sabre's musical. I saw a reading of it in the fall that was really terrifically done. I'm not going to see the same cast because actually this is a college production. Point Park College in Pittsburgh is going to be doing it. But the show is really terrific and an adaptation of that movie of some years ago. And very skillfully done. These are very talented writers, needless to say. And for me to drive all the way out to Pittsburgh says something.
All right, so I think we'll wrap it up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side where the Broadway Radio logo is, there's a button to subscribe. That way, every time we have a new episode, it'll be automatically downloaded to your iTunes and you can listen to it. Or you can go to BroadwayStars.com and listen to it there as well. If you want to reach out and touch us, leave us a message about your favorite shows or your favorite story about Sondheim for the upcoming show, please give us a call at 646-873-7695 and leave a message. And you can also send us an email through the contact form on the front page of BroadwayStars.com. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Good morning.
Bye.
Well, it's technically afternoon now, but bye.
Oh, you're right. Good day. Bye-bye.
That's so bad.
Too many mornings wasted in pretending I reach for you. How many mornings are there still to come? How much time can we hope that there will be? Not much time, but it's time enough for me.